Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm William English, and today's guest is Barry Miles, known as Miles ever since when?
Ever since I was in art college. We did a college magazine, and there were six of us on the staff. Three of us were called Barry, so I went for Miles, being an artist and all, Picasso, Braque.
So it just stuck. It's been Miles.
It's no big deal though. Yeah, it's not a secret. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, all the books have got Barry written on the front.
Yes, they have, haven't they? Yes. Yeah. Although the Miles are usually in block capitals,
that's
and
it.
The Barry is in sort of lowercase. But okay, Miles is the author of In the 60s, Allen Ginsberg, a biography, The Beat Hotel. Jack Kerouac, King of the Beats, Paul McCartney, Many Years From Now, and William Burroughs, El Hombre Invisible.
Invisible.
why El Hombre Invisible?
Oh, well, that was what he was known as in Tangier by all the Spanish boys living there. Because Burroughs always had this thing of fitting in wherever he was. When he was living here in London, in Mayfair, he just wore a three-piece suit, he had his shoes made at Lobs, and he was totally anonymous. He would move around St. James's, no one would see him. Right. But when he was in Tangier, he wore a burnous and, carried a sort of bag of oranges and stuff. And again, everyone just thought he was a local.
Right.
But when he moved to Kansas, eventually, he got a sort of bib overall and a peak cap, with the name of a feed company or something on it, and he just looked like an old farmer. He was just he was always El Hombre Invisible.
Okay. To have your shoes made at Lobs, that was a seriously expensive shoe shop, wasn't it?
This is certainly true, yeah. Still, but he had very, very long, thin feet, and he did need special shoes.
So, right.
So I think the expense was probably worth it.
He had family money? Or?
His grandfather invented the adding machine. So the Burroughs Corporation is, as it was called then, was a family concern. But they sold out during the Depression and lost most of the money. So the sort of rumor that he had these millions behind him is not really true.
No?
The family kept a small amount of shares, and I think his father sold them in the 30s or something and started a glass manufacturing company, and then eventually when they retired, his parents had a garden furniture shop in Florida called Cobblestone Gardens, which is the name of one of Bill's books, in fact, and they used to give him $200 a month, which is what he lived on until the mid-60s, actually.
Oh, right.
So,
right.
I mean, $200 a month back in the 50s, you could live very well in somewhere like Tangier or Mexico City.
Yeah. Yeah,
but there weren't the millions behind him. That,
right?
Some people
that was a sort of rumor, isn't it? And basically, we're talking about Burroughs because there's a forthcoming exhibition actually it's an unnamed gallery as yet. I think
it's called 55 Hills Muse. I think.
Yeah.
It's behind Mags Brothers Rare Books on Berkeley Square.
And it's part of Mags Brothers.
Yes, but I'm pretty sure they're going to have a separate entrance in the back there. I
mean, right.
There's a door out into the mews, so you won't have to trudge through, half a block of rare books.
And when's the exhibition on?
Well, I wish I could tell you exactly, but it's mid January.
Right.
We took the photographs in to be framed only this morning.
Right.
Sounds like you have a message.
It certainly does, doesn't it? There we are. It's the end of that. Okay.
Good.
Sorry about that.
Live radio. Yeah.
Okay, so
there's a lot of Burroughs stuff going on at the moment. There's a show happening at the Royal Academy next week, which is screenings of a number of his videos, and I think some of the Anthony Bolsch stuff is being screened as well.
Right.
And there's photographs by people like Robert Mapplethorpe and other famous celebrities whose names I've forgotten.
Yeah.
Exhibition of book jackets and things like that. I mean, it's a sort of celebration of Burroughs, from what I gather. I haven't seen it yet. It doesn't open until Monday. And then there's a show of his decorated file folders. It sounds an odd thing. Yeah. At the Riflemaker Gallery in Beak Street, which is open already, I think. Yeah, I think it opened this week, but the official opening's next week. But those are the manila folders that he kept his manuscripts in.
Right.
And when he was in his sort of painting mode, he would paint anything. I mean, jackets, ties, you know, anything he could get his hands on. And so the folders he kept his manuscripts in were all highly decorated with abstract calligraphic painting, really, kind of graffiti, which was a sort of run on from the stuff he did in Tangier and in London in the 60s and later on in the 70s in New York, when he used to decorate his scrapbooks by sticking photographs in and news clippings and generally creating what he called sets, really, which were the sort of environments that he could create characters from. So, and then when Brian Gysin died, he began to paint a lot more. He would never paint when Brian was still alive, because Brian was his closest friend, and he felt that Brian would feel threatened if he started to write, if he started to paint as well. So when Brian died, he began to paint a great deal more, and these are a good example, I guess, of his everyday painting, shall we say.
And is Gysin's having an exhibition of his at the October Gallery?
That opened a couple of days ago, and that's there's some really nice work there, actually. The October Gallery on Gloucester.
Yes,
Street,
Old Gloucester Street, I think, just off Queen Square, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah.
So why this sudden, why have we got three Burroughs exhibitions on all at the same time? What's happening?
I think it's purely accidental, actually.
Yeah.
It's, it's 11 years now since he died. There's been, new books coming out all the time. His Mexico City and South American journals came out. There was one of his notebooks has been published by us in a big scholarly facsimile edition by an American university. It came out about a year ago. There was a little while ago the revised text edition of Naked Lunch came out. That James Grauholtz, who's the heir to the Burroughs estate and his literary executor. James and I went back to the original manuscripts for Naked Lunch and tried to get a definitive text. And Penguin, in fact, are bringing it out in February, I think, this year. Although it's already out here, you can get a much cheaper edition.
Right,
But there is a new edition from Penguin coming out soon. So he's just becoming part of the canon now, you know. I mean, it takes about a decade, you know, after somebody dies, and then they're they become respectable suddenly.
So in your show at the Mags Brothers, what will you be exhibiting particularly? What's going to be in this show?
Well, this is his photographs of London. It's about 110 photographs taken by him, or just over 100 anyway, taken by him, plus a few pictures of him that I took and some that Brian Gysin took. And they are a whole series of, you could call them psychogeographical studies, I suppose, in that he believed that if you could cut things up, if you could see things afresh by looking at things from different angles and doing sort of cubist style collages of visual information, that you could see things afresh, particularly things like the view from his window, something that you see every day and in the end becomes totally stale, you don't see it at all. So he would make a point of taking, quite regularly he would go to his window and take photographs from slightly different angles and print them up and compare them with the actual view and try and remain here and now in the present and not controlled by memory fading or his whole idea that we're all programmed by a movie anyway, it's all on tape. And he had many, many theories about cut-ups. The whole cut-up technique was a way of cutting through surface reality and getting down to some much greater understanding of the world. And he took it one stage further into... he really thought that you could actually attack what he calls, the control system of word and image, and particularly the... in his period of time, it would have been Time Life and the big information control centers, CIA, etc., etc. We're going back to sort of 60s conspiracy theories here.
Yeah.
But he believed that if you cut through the lines and cut up texts, you get to some deeper understanding of what was really being said in the first place. And so you're not as controlled by these things. Although he always believed that language was some form of virus, and that if you could get beyond the written word, in particular, that you were capable of a much greater sort of understanding of who you were and what the world was about. I mean, I suppose going back to nature, I mean, a rather possibly simplistic sort of view of living naturally. For instance, he once told me that he believed that in the Arab world it would be almost impossible to psychoanalyze somebody who lived in one of these little villages, these illiterate villages, just because they had no ego and superego. They hadn't been controlled by by language, by the written word, by all the information that we're bombarded with. And by extension, he felt that using word and tape and photographs, you could decontaminate yourself, I think, even living in the 20th century city. So one set of experiments he did was, because he received such rude treatment and as he put it, poisonous cheesecake in a particular cafe on Frith Street called the Mocha Bar, he decided to close them down with a big word and image attack. So every day he would go past and he would tape record them and take photographs of the place. It's in one of his books. He says, they know I'm out here, I can see them cowering. And so and sure enough, he said business fell off, sort of the old proprietor looked more miserable every day.
Oh my God.
Finally, they closed, and it was reopened under the name of the Queen's Coffee Bar, which William, being an old queen, was very pleased with.
Yeah. Okay. Now he lived.
So we've got those. That's a series of 10 photographs there.
I mean, photographs of the coffee bar.
Exactly. It was the Mocha Coffee Bar, as a matter of fact, which was the first espresso coffee bar in Britain. Opened in about 15. I don't know when it happened, at 61 or something.
Right.
No, late 50s.
Yeah. Late 50s, Okay. Now, he apparently lived on Duke Street, St. James, didn't he, for quite a while?
He moved to London. Well, he lived here on and off in the early 60s, when he was with Ian Somerville. And he had places on Lancaster Terrace and a Trebevoort hotel. Hotel Rembrandt, I think it was, a number of hotels. But he was never here for very long. He was always flitting back to the Beat Hotel in Paris and then down to Tangier.
Yeah.
But then in 65, he had he'd left Tangier in at the end of 64 and gone to live in New York for 7 months. Mm. Then he returned to London and spent a very short time at the Cavendish Hotel and moved into Duke Street, St. James, where he lived for 9 years.
Right.
So that was one of the longest times he's lived anywhere, actually, ever, I think, in his whole life.
And that was basically just around the corner from Indica.
It was.
Which was the famous bookshop in Mason's Yard, which you founded.
I did,
Yes.
Well, not just me. It was John Dunbar, Peter Asher and myself started a company called MAD, Miles Asher and Dunbar.
Oh.
And Indica was the bookshop art gallery. It was on Mason's Yard, which is where White Cube now is, of course. Where the White Cube gallery is now used to be an electricity substation with a very famous gentleman's lavatory on the side of it for well known for cottaging.
Meeting
and all
place.
That. Yes. A meeting place. That's the and William could look down into Mason's Yard from his back window and also at the back of the London Library.
Right.
So he would come in all the time. And Ian Somerville, who was actually living with him when we first opened, did all of our electricity and, put all the wires and stuff in. And I suppose that the only reason people still remember Indica is, in fact, the Beatles' connection to it. And when we were setting up in Mason's Yard, Paul McCartney, for instance, came and helped put up the shelves and paint the walls and stuff.
Yeah.
And he also designed our wrapping paper, which was a secret, actually. He'd locked himself in his room in the Asher house where he was living for 2 or 3 days, and nobody knew what he was doing in there. People would tap nervously on the door, are you all right, Paul? And he'd actually, instead of using Letraset or anything like that, he'd actually hand-drawn the whole thing. It was with a sort of, like an English flag with Indica Books and Gallery and the address and everything.
Yeah.
And then he took it to have it printed, and like 5,000 sheets. But of course, he went to an art printer, so they were really on nice paper. So, and then the day we opened, he just arrived in his Aston, and you know, in the back there was this huge block of wrapping paper, and we had endless requests from American fans, you know, who would all send American stamps, you know, of course, which were useless to us, you know, asking for copies. They didn't want to buy any books; they just wanted the wrapping paper.
Yeah.
I believe copies go for, you know, quite a lot of money these days.
I'll bet they do, yeah. So, and then Indica, how long did it last in Mason's Yard?
Well, it didn't last long. The gallery was there for 2 years. Right. The bookshop was only there for about 7 months before we realised that really the gallery needed pristine space, to be quite honest. And a bookshop is inherently messy. You know, there's always piles of papers and books and stuff everywhere. So we moved the bookshop to Southampton Row, to 102 Southampton Row, and then the gallery was able to expand up from the basement into the ground floor.
Yeah.
And I think the first show on the ground floor was the Yoko Ono show, which was her first show in Europe. It may have even been her first solo show, apart from her studio shows in
So is that the famous show where she met John Lennon?
It is indeed. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I was there.
Were you?
Yeah. It was the day before the Vernissage. It was, we were still hanging the stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure why John dropped by. I mean, maybe John Dunbar invited him. He and John Dunbar used to spend a lot of time together experimenting. Mm-hmm. And he was often, you know, about the place. So, there were about 10 people there, I think. And I remember as soon as Yoko saw him, she sort of grabbed his hand and gave him the tour.
So how long did it continue at Southampton Street?
It went on, Southampton Row. February 29th, 1970, we closed.
Right.
So it ran for, I don't know, 7 years, I guess. We opened in late 65, September 65, and then we moved right through to...
And you started the International Times in the basement of...
That's right, not long after we moved to Southampton Row, John Hopkins and myself had been publishing little magazines and spoken word records. We did a spoken word record of Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, Corso, and Andrea Voznesensky. But really what we wanted to do was a Village Voice, or actually more specifically one of the American underground papers like East Village Other, which I was the English correspondent for Evo, East Village Other. But we also realized we couldn't do it ourselves because we both had other jobs. I mean, Hoppy was a photographer at that point. And so we enlarged the editorial board, as it were, and got in people like Jim Haynes and Jack Henry Moore. And we managed to persuade Tom McGrath to return to London, who had been editing Peace News, the CND newspaper.
How was it distributed, the International Times?
It was, we couldn't get Smiths or anybody to take it, obviously. No. So we simply had street sellers. You know, you give them a bundle, and if they don't come back, then you don't sell them anymore in the future. So most of them used to come back, you know, and they made a reasonable income out of it.
Right.
And then we had people who would, well, the people who became the Magic Bus, in fact, started up as taking copies to Holland. They would take really a lot, actually. I mean, like a couple of thousand or something to Amsterdam in a bus. And, of course, people said, well, if you're off to Amsterdam, perhaps I can come along and help share the expenses. So in the end, it turned in more into a bus service than into a distribution service. And they started to go every week or every other day or something. So yeah, I mean, it was always it's all high sort of high hippie culture here.
Yes, So any regrets for that period? I mean, do you wish it could have carried on as a bookshop?
The only reason it closed was so many people liberated the books, as they call it.
Oh, really? Right.
I still meet people, they say, I stole those books. God. I mean, you know, they're the ones who bloody closed it, you know.
Yeah.
So because they knew we're not going to take them to court, right? You know, I mean, by almost by definition, the kind of people we were and the kind of shop it was. So the theft rate was just unbelievable, you know. So that's what did us in.
Oh, was it? Okay.
I think Compendium had the same problem.
Right. In fact, there was a talk by Nick Rochford, which we broadcast it about 2 weeks ago, talking about the history of Compendium. And that sort of, he ended by mentioning Indica. the Indica Bookshop, but of course also Better Books.
Right, which I also managed.
Which you managed, didn't you, before you did Indica.
That's right, yeah.
And he also talks about Bill Butler and the Unicorn Bookshop in Brighton and so on.
That was a wonderful shop. Yeah. Well, Better Books was started by Tony Godwin back in 1948, and it was a place where the angry young men used to hang out, you know, sort of Colin Wilson and John Brain and all these, you know, guys. I didn't get involved until, about end of 64, I think, which is when Bill Butler was managing it.
Yeah.
And then Bill and his boyfriend wanted to move to Brighton, and because his boyfriend had TB or something, I think, and they thought, you know, the air would be nicer. And also, I think he wanted to get away from London and have a, you know, generally healthier life.
Yeah.
So he went off, and Tony appointed me manager of the paperback section, not the whole shop.
Was it called Better Books in 48?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I always assumed it was a sort of 60s bookshop.
A lot of people do, but it's always had a big, you know, it's always been central to cultural activity in London like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it ran parallel to Archer's famous bookshop on Greek Street, but that only lasted for a couple of years, I think, at the most. Yeah. So, it was always a big centre. And Tony was the editorial director of Penguin, so he had quite a he had quite a powerful position, and he also was able, of course, to always have the complete stock of Penguins, and you know, there on sale or return. So, you know, financially, it was good. I mean, he had a whole wall of thousands of Penguins, so that was pretty good.
Okay.
And then Bob Cobbing, of course, very shortly after I started to manage it, Bob joined the staff, and. Then when I left Start Indica, Bob took over as the manager, and but all the whole time, all through 65, that we were having readings and film shows and stuff, and I put on a reading by Allen Ginsberg, for instance, in I guess July of 65, and one of Ferlinghetti, and we released albums of those two readings, and then Bob did an album of himself doing a sound poetry reading, which I think was his first sort of commercial recording, and it was Bob who did the all the film evenings.
I mean,
he started, I think this must have been around the same time the London Filmmakers Co-op started.
I was just going to say that's where it started, wasn't it?
Because I remember endless meetings going on in the basement about that.
Yes.
And screenings of interesting material.
Yeah.
Very nice stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a very exciting time. You know, lots of stuff going on.
Okay, well, we're talking to Miles, or otherwise known as Barry Miles, who is curating a show at Mag's Bookshop in January of William Burroughs. And you've brought along, this is a CD that you produced,
yes,
I think.
Yes, this is pretty obscure, this one.
Is it?
So these are William's... Burroughs extended the idea of cutting up words on the page into cutting up tapes as well. Mm-hmm. And these are random experiments, random drop-ins of him reading newspaper headlines, Moroccan drumming, pneumatic drills, other unspecified sounds, guaranteed to clear the room and get all your listeners to turn off.
So you produced this?
In as much as I chose the tapes. And
it's called Real English Tea Made Here.
Yes, that's named after one of the photographs in there.
And it's a 3-CD set. And that's available from anywhere?
I think at the moment it's only available from the Royal Academy Bookshop. But it's released by Liverpool John Moores University.
Yeah.
So I'm sure somebody will find a way of...
Well, should we listen to... We could listen to a few minutes of this.
Yeah, sure.
As we've got a few minutes left. I don't know, can't remember which track this is, actually. It's
old track would do.
Old Farmer's Almanac.
Clothes spilled in the streets. Laid my dirty purple dust-tainted junky fingers on his sepia sharkskin sleeve. Purple peeling, feel them junky fingers far away his sharkskin sleeve. Old Farmer's Almanac on the back.
Turn the dregs of it upon this varlet here. This who like a block has denied my access to thee.
Away. Wife, mother, child, I know not. My affairs are...
Low Sunday. Sad year. Shard wreckage, please. 1,000 yards. A boy, please. I was supposed
to... lies in Vauxhall breath. But we have been familiar. In great forgetfulness shall poison rather than pity note how much.
Will not my voice be on the crossing? Please help me get out. Callione, Callione. Kim did this, you hear me? Hanged himself with his belt from the top of the East Double Dress Sunday. Mark at the Easter date. So this is what happens to D.C. deals. Over the snow-capped mountains, Henry. Here's a strain. Santiago, Chile. Airliner. One Santiago.
Take this along. I writ it for thy sake and would have sent it.
Five Puerto Ricans since February. And later the snow cover Frankie. Mountain. Low Sunday. Sad year's lowest PM this ash.
This man, Ophidius, was my beloved in Rome. Yet thou behold.
Rome has fallen to the ground. Finished. The tour ends. Juan Santiago, February 6th. Item concerned a plane. Meet. Crash off Jones Beach. Him. Cap Mountain. Santiago hanged him.
Is your name Menenius?
'Tis a spell, you see, of much power. You're now the way home again. Do you hear?
Dead job here. Abandoned trip to England. Bring my brother home. We had not thought. The plane's charred wreckage was true. You only one called this. We didn't. Frozen world in his eyes. Common law wife, he slew April 12 by stabbing her 23 times. Death, top of a double bunk, you got no basis. Plain Mr. Jones, or Mr. Even me, Jay, if you prefer.
For such things as you, I can scarce think that any. You're so slight. He that has a will to die by himself.
Tourist. Stop dash so many. Not seen each other in a long time. Death of Santiago. For a week. Most ancient cocktail lounge. Glove, names, and it won't hurt. Death on Valentine Day, February 14th. It's getting dark. Months, he was demanding a cut of the Dutchman's percentage. When the outraged Schultz said no, Cole started a rival organization.
Long, and your misery increase with your age. I say to you, as I was sent to, away!
Yes, Schultz said, Get coal off my back. Get the mech off my back. Oh, from the last DS words. Sunday. Eighteen police stations, Henry, Frankie.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, The Art of Listening.
Right, my name is Rajesh.